Good evening, everybody, to Masterclass this evening, this Thursday, 8/10/2023. So glad that you could join us. We have a great group, six presentations this evening. I do have the agenda in the chat, so you can see their names and topics that they will be talking about this evening. They are all 15 minutes, so it should go pretty fast. But definitely, I'm sure there's a couple of on here that I really want to watch, like pivot tables. That one's going to be good for me because I'm never good at pivot tables. So I can't wait for that one, Philip. But I'm going to go ahead and start this one off with Dakota, if you are ready.
Sounds good. Yeah, let me share. And let me know if y'all can see that.
Yes, we can.
Great.
Yep.
All right. So my presentation is over detecting diabetic retinopathy using machine learning. And this is actually a project that I've been working on for the last month or two. A friend of mine works for a company that deals with like diabetes treatment. And he asked me to help them with this because there are companies that already do this, but it's proprietary software that they either don't want to share or they charge a lot to share. So his company wants their own to do this. So I've been trying to help him with that. And at the end, if you have questions about diabetic retinopathy itself, I probably don't have the answers. I only know enough to work on the program. He handles all of that stuff. But to start off, diabetic retinopathy, it's a form of vision loss that's caused by diabetes. It occurs whenever blood vessels in the retina are damaged. And that causes either blurry or partially blocked vision. It's measured in four stages. So five stages technically, but there's four stages of retinopathy, 1 through 4. And then 0 is just no retinopathy. And it's the most common cause of vision loss in working age adults. So in the diagram down here, you can kind of see it. But there's fatty deposits that build up around blood vessels. And then those blood vessels can rupture, and then that's what causes the vision loss. And those are the two main things that we're going to be trying to see using computer vision, because that's the easiest things to see in the fundus imaging. And the scans are called fundus images, by the way. So these are examples of each stage. And from 0 to 1, personally, I don't see any difference in those. Those look the exact same for this project. So it's very difficult to see between the levels, especially early on. But if you look down at like 3 and 4, on 3, you can see some small dots. Those are those fatty deposits that I was mentioning that start to build up. And then at 4, you can see a lot more along the edges where those blood vessels have ruptured and started to leak into the retina. So there's 8 images here. One of these is a 4. So just in chat, just drop a quick guess of which one of these that you think is a 4 on the retinopathy scale. All right, so the answers we're getting, you guys can already start to see how difficult this is because we're getting tons of different guesses. And the fun part is that all of you are wrong. None of these are 4s. These are all 0s. All of these are no retinopathy detected. So this is the kind of range and variation that we're working with in trying to detect this. Because, you know, if they all look the same and the only difference was those blood vessels and those fatty deposits, this would have taken me maybe 4 hours and I wouldn't even bother making a presentation about it today. So some of the conceptual challenges, as I just mentioned, is the wide variations. They're wildly different between each one before you even account for the fact that some of them have retinopathy and some don't. Those small, tiny little details, like the little dots that were in the 3s that you saw, they're very small and hard to detect, especially when you have to start crunching resolution. And as it says in the third one, This takes an astounding amount of computational power. I built my personal computer less than a year ago, was very excited about how strong it was. It's worthless for this. It cannot do any of the things I need it to do, and I'm having to scale down a lot to compensate for that. Then on just my side of trying to do this project, using TensorFlow's GPU acceleration, which is which is what I've been, the package I've been using to train this model. On Windows, you have to use 2.1. I think the most current version right now is 2.4 something. And then I use PyCharm as my IDE. So I've had to create the environment in Anaconda and then use that as the interpreter to use the correct versions. And then the original data set that I'm using, it's from a Kaggle competition from a few years ago. It's about 85% zeros. And so when I was originally training it and I was looking at my accuracy scores, I was getting 85, 90% accuracy, thought it was doing great. And then when I actually built a checker for it, found out that it was actually just predicting everything is zero because I didn't print a confusion matrix. So I thought I was getting 85% when really it was just zeros every single time. And this is also the first big machine learning project that I personally worked on. And that was a mistake. This is much more difficult than what someone just starting should be doing. But, you know, competition against yourself breeds excellence, I guess. And then also, again, as I mentioned, the computational limits. What I've been doing to try to limit the load is I'm only training the left eye. I'm not doing left and right at the same time. And I'm just predicting zero or there is retinopathy, so 1 through 4. So this page here, these are all of the errors, or some of the errors that I have copy and pasted into ChatGPT because I didn't know what it meant. Because, again, this is my first big project using TensorFlow and Keras. And these are a bunch of different ones that I've had to ask for help. And most of the times it's, you know, one tab over, some white space, a comma, and then a bunch of different versions of the code that I've just copy and pasted into Notepad files to keep on the side. All right, so I'm starting this by cropping down the training images, this little basic code using CV2 just to cut down on computational power. Just every pixel I can get rid of is a little bit more memory I get to use on my GPU. And then this is the current code that I'm using. This is the very basic version of the model. If you look closely, you'll see some of the details of like that I'm having to resize to 600 by 600 resolution. The original scans are anywhere from 1080p to 4K. So that's a lot of compression. And when you're compressing using this and have such small details, that really, really cuts down on your accuracy even more. And this is a brief explanation of the code. If you're interested, I'm sure you can read through this real quick, but I won't go through it every piece. But essentially, just loading it in, training it using a VGG16 model, freezing the top layers to try to get down to those finer details, running it for 10 epochs, and then printing out the results. And if you're wondering how it currently does, bad. Currently, the program does not work at all. I'm getting about 50% accuracy each time, which means it's just firing blindly from the hips and is not predicting anything correctly. So how I'm trying to improve right now, again, I've said it about 10 times now, more computational power. That lets me up the resolution, increase the training data size. I have about 17,000 scans for each side that I can use. Right now, I'm only using like 4,000, I think, just to reduce that a little bit. Pre-processing the training images a little bit more to normalize them, since we have such big variations, like the different colors, different zoom levels, trying to normalize those, try to get them all kind of the same color, same brightness. Excuse me. To make it a little bit easier to detect. And then the big step that I want to try next is adjusting the model to focus on some specific areas. So the macula is the dark spot that you might have noticed in the scans that I showed before. That's usually where the fatty deposits build up first. So I'm thinking that maybe if I could focus on that area a little bit more, then it might be able to detect those finer details a little bit better. And then also I might change the model because currently VGG16 is a pretty big model that just loading it alone before I even put data in it, it's already using up a lot of the VRAM. So something less complex might let me get more data in there or up the resolutions. And then the final thoughts, I'm sure several of you in the chat are thinking, why don't you just use cloud computing? I'm also looking into that. I refuse to use Google Cloud because I hate Google Cloud. I used it before for their with their free trial, $300 or whatever. I accidentally went over, forgot that Google already has my information, ended up charging myself a couple hundred dollars on a side project that meant nothing. So now I refuse to ever use it again. And then this project has been a lot more difficult than I thought it would be. When my friend asked me about it, I thought it'd be fairly simple. Now, here we are 2 months later, and I've made effectively no progress. But I've learned much, much more about machine learning and Python just doing this project than probably every class that I took combined. Excuse me, sorry, I've been sick. Computer vision, it's not for the faint of heart. If you don't like coding that much and you don't like seeing error messages at the bottom of your screen after waiting an hour for a program to run, don't do this. It's not worth it. And don't be afraid to use ChatGPT when you're coding. Now, if you're just going in and just saying Python, how to print hello world code, yeah, that's kind of cheating. But using it to run things like errors is that's the same thing you're going to do on Google. You're just going to Google the error, just put it into ChatGPT. You'll probably get the answer just faster. And then lastly, does anyone have any questions, comments, or concerns? Michael.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about using ChatGPT as a debugger. You would say that that's helped you a lot?
An unbelievable amount. That is, it is an incredible tool for trying to debug. It's not always going to be right. That's the reality of it. If you give it the error, it tells you change this, and then you change it and it doesn't work, then your bet my the first suggestion is open a new chat, because once ChatGPT gets stuck in a loop on itself, it just starts printing more and more wrong things. Also, upgrading to GPT-4 will help you a lot. It is significantly better than 3.5, but it's still, even if you're only using 3.5, it is very helpful. And Dr. Moore.
Yeah, I was going to tell you. So first of all, the whole neuropathy issue is natural intelligence doesn't even understand it. Those are very arbitrary defined states. Trust me,
Yes.
I have a grant out on diabetes now, and we don't, it's very poorly defined. But what I was going to suggest to you is dropping the collar, go to monochrome, and then do a mask with the state zero so you can look for the differences between states one and four and use that training data set. That will reduce the amount of data you need to crunch, as well as focusing in on what are the differences.
So I did try Grayscale and it did not have any luck with it,
But
but
what
I'm
I could
actually
do, I would definitely, what you want to do is you want to subtract out all the normalities and you only want to look for the abnormalities, because that's what the natural intelligence people are doing. That's what they're doing to classify one, two, three, four. So basically taking them and creating a mask, then subtracting that from your disease states and using that as the data set. We could talk about this later, but anyway, I mean, this is what I do. Okay.
I'm actually my friend who works for the company that I mentioned earlier that I'm working on this project with. We're actually trying to find free time for both of us to get on a call together right now because I want him to look through different versions of normalization to help me see when we can see the differences. Because again, I am very bad at seeing the difference in a zero and a two. So that way I could let him look at all the different versions of normalization and let him tell me which ones are pulling out the right information, which ones aren't, rather than running 100 different versions of this trying to find out.
Yeah, that's what I was suggesting. I mean, it would be a perfect experiment to subtract out normal from abnormalities that people have identified, and then using the machine language to maybe suggest something that might be something we don't know about. I mean, that's the whole point here, really.
That makes sense, Landon, because as you use it, if you're using a less colored version of those, you're going to see it more like it's a negative instead of what it is. And then it will just take the differences between the gamma of the dark and the light.
Yeah, yeah. And by doing a mask to get rid of all the stuff that is normal, you're looking for anything that's different. And trust me, I don't do the optical stuff, but, you know, running, you know, many thousands of genes through ML stuff tasks my computers too.
I'm sure. Yeah. Wow. That was really, really interesting. Let me tell you, that was a great presentation. Something to think about because, you know, you worry about that, right?
Yeah. Well, I worry about it. I'm at a zero for me, but that's what they tell me when they check my eyes to make sure I don't have, you know, any deposits in my eyes.
Right. And my mother's the same thing. So I wonder about her eyes. I wonder if it affects your hearing at all because she's starting to lose her hearing.
I think that might be a wax thing.
Yeah. I'm wondering.
Yeah. Wax.
Like, mom?
Yeah.
Okay. All jokes aside, yes, this is good. Very good information. Thank you so much, Dakota. That's great.
That's very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay, now we can move on to John. Are you ready?
I am. Now, there is a bit of an issue. My masterclass was actually structured to be more of a 30-minute masterclass, so I'm not sure if I should present now or we should like work out something else for a different schedule, as, you know, might go over the time limit for this meeting, or like what would we like to do?
Go right ahead. Go ahead and start.
Alrighty.
Yep. And we'll maybe if we can
just talk fast.
I guess. I don't want to rush you, but hey, you know, sometimes we think it goes that way, but you might end up being faster than you think. So
I've practicing an auctioneer.
Right. Yeah. No. Give it a try. Go ahead.
Let's see. Okay.
And yeah, because this is all optional, so you know anybody can leave whenever they need to. So that works.
Gotcha. Okay, let me just bring this up. Okay, where's my? There we go. Okay. Hello. The presentation is on effective and efficient research alongside its benefits for us as academics and IT professionals. Okay, so how research occurs to us. What is research? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines the term research as an investigation or experimentation aimed at the discovery and interpretation of facts, revision of accepted theories or laws in light of new facts, or practical application of such new or revised theories or laws. Research and the act of studying for our own personal knowledge is typically better absorbed over a small period of time within a larger time frame, in opposition to attempting to memorize everything in a single learning session. This is because of the spacing effect, which was first pioneered by the German philosopher Ebbinghaus in 1885. The spacing effect specifically demonstrates that learning is more effective when repeated in spaced out sessions. By repeating and spacing out information, individuals learn. They can better recall that information in the future. Next slide here. Alrighty, defining research goals. Direction builds inertia, which leads to achievement. Defining your research goals is integral to giving it direction. This will assist in gaining inertia in the research process, along with the drive to continue the search for more extensive and reliable data to assist in your research. Now, before conducting research, it is important to clearly define your goals. This includes determining what you want to achieve, what research questions you want to answer, and what methods you will use to conduct your research. Healthy questioning of these goals in a systematic format can allow you to focus your efforts in a more helpful direction if you find that you are getting off track. Some questions to ask yourself are, what do I want to achieve? What do I want to solve? Am I setting out to solve something? How do I go about solving this? And will going through this process help myself or another fellow researcher? Alrighty. So here is the research and learning. This essentially shows a list. It's going to be a repeating process that shows the relationship that learning and research have with one another. So first, we happen upon a topic. Just, there we go. Then we acquire an interest in said topic. Next slide, please. Okay. Then the hunger for that knowledge then grows. We research through sources of known knowledge. You begin to comprehend the knowledge. You then retain that knowledge over time, and then the cycle continues. Okay, what makes research practical? Both applied and basic research methods are typically used to gather information, facts, and help build knowledge around a subject of research. Practical or applied research, in opposition to basic research, has foundations in the idea of applying research to solve specific problems that you would find in a real-world situation. Practical research is a huge part of many individuals' lives, whether they recognize it or not. The search for information among people today is typically the first reaction to being held up by a lack of knowledge, thanks to the massive amounts of data freely available due to the internet and free sources of knowledge, such as public libraries. Okay, so this is a continuation of what makes practical research. Practical research should be relevant to our lives or work, providing us with useful insights and information. Relevance is an important factor in many facets of life, and practical research is no exception to this rule. Relevant data and information allows our research to remain in specific contexts that we denote for ourselves. Practical research must be feasible in terms of time, resources, and available technology. It is important to understand that feasibility is what allows for practical research to hold meaning in the long run. If one does not have the time, resources, or technology, then our research lacks one of the crucial ingredients to become practical and applicable to specific situations at hand. Ethics in research allows us to move forward with ease and confidence that all participants maintain a certain level of safety and mediates any issues that could arise. Ethical practices and protocol should always be present, but be observed especially well when working alongside colleagues or other research participants. Research must be conducted ethically, ensuring the safety and well-being of all participants and acknowledging any potential biases or conflicts of interest. Okay, let's move on here. Alrighty, differences in academic and lifelong learning. Academic learning. Research is an essential component of academic learning, helping students develop critical thinking, problem solving, and analytical skills. With most of us being interns, I feel that we have gathered a specific amount of knowledge in the topics covered in this slide. Academic learning contributes greatly to the research process, but it's not the only way one can develop the skills necessary for personal research. All right, lifelong learning. Through research, we can continue to learn and expand our knowledge throughout our lives, improving our personal and professional development. Although this concept is becoming more relevant as time goes on, it seems appropriate to cover this topic as some individuals have displayed an aversion to learning consistently and constantly, despite the proliferation of the internet. This form of learning holds just as much relevance and importance as academic learning, as taking interest in something and pursuing knowledge can lead anyone down a well of knowledge that has the potential to benefit their or another's future forever. Okay. How can research assist us in our careers? Identifying areas of improvement. This involves reviewing work such as code or planning and obtaining feedback from colleagues to help the identification process. Research can help us identify areas for improvement in our work, allowing us to make more informed decisions and take targeted actions. Developing skills. Research, practicing research frequently allows us to develop as researchers, both academically and casually, which could assist us in learning from data more quickly over time. Research can help us develop new skills and knowledge that can enhance our professional development and career growth. Staying ahead of trends. Keeping up with relevant trends can further our careers and demonstrate to current and potential employers that we are proactive in our fields and can educate ourselves considering emerging technologies and information. By staying up to date with research in our field, we can stay ahead of emerging trends and remain competitive in the job market. And finally, making informed decisions. Research can help us better understand a topic, idea, or situation at hand and allows us to make the most beneficial decision at the time for ourselves and others, i.e. like company, others like family, friends, etc. By conducting and utilizing research, we can make more informed decisions about our careers and professional development. Okay. Examples of flexible research designs. So we have three here. We have case studies, grounded theory, and participatory action research. Case studies are an in-depth exploration of a real-life context, often using a variety of research methods, such as interviews, surveys, and observations. Grounded theory is an That's strange. Sorry, I have a little bit of an error with my slide here. I'm just going to pass over grounded theory right now. Participatory action research, a collaborative approach to research that involves active participating from all stakeholders, including community members, to identify problems and implement solutions. In the following slides, we'll be looking at case studies, grounded theory, and participatory action research, or PAR, in more detail, including the steps necessary to comprehend these concepts better. Okay, case studies. To quote an explanation by dovetail.com, case study research is a process by which researchers examine a real-life specific object or subject in a thorough and detailed way. The process of conducting a case study is as such. So first, you have case selection. Once you have identified the problem, you will then identify the case that you will specifically focus on. This means that you will be more certain on what exactly will be covered, such as providing more insights, more in-depth insights, or expanding upon previous knowledge, challenging assumptions that have already been set in place, and possibly paving the way for more extensive research by yourself slash another team in the future. The second is the creation of a theoretical framework. An individual or group that would be conducting a case study must have it linked to existing knowledge to prevent it from becoming an isolated description. This allows for previously researched information to become enhanced through a more recent study and has the potential for prompting future studies to question established material if it does not align with theories that were once thought to be true. The third is to collect data. Case studies are usually filled with qualitative data, such as observations, interviews, and sources of information, but can include quantitative data or numerical data that can assist us and others in understanding the information. Fourth is analyzing your case. While conducting your study, it is important to review it for ease of presentation and explanation that will allow one to give detailed contextual understanding to your audience and those who would be met with it. This allows for smooth teaching if presenting to others and giving yourself a simple context to return to if expanding upon your research in the future. Okay, next we have grounded theory. A research method that seeks to develop theory from data that has been systematically collected and analyzed. So, an example from Harappa Education is grounded theory is often used by the HR department. For instance, they might study why employees are frustrated by their work. Employees can explain what they feel is lacking to HR. And then HR would gather this data, examine the results to discover the root cause of their problems, and then present solutions. All righty. Now we're getting into PAR. So based on the description provided by FAO.org, PAR is a continuous cycle in which insiders and outsiders together decide what needs to be researched, design the research, and collect the necessary information. This information is then put into practical applications or used to identify new research ideas. The process of PAR is as such. So first, you're going to want to identify. Both researchers and participants must work together to understand the problem at hand, which involves the identification of both the issue and how to approach the solution. Second is to educate. Researchers will typically work toward both understanding the solution and the education of participants to grant them a greater awareness of the subject, in addition to broadening their horizon of thought. This breadth of knowledge provides benefits to everyone and allows for a superior researching process overall. Third is action. After the previous steps, both researchers and participants emerge with a greater overall perception and understanding of the matter at hand, which then allows them to implement a range of solutions based on the efforts of all involved. With researchers competently gathering new knowledge, participants educated with the knowledge provided to them and empowered to assist in gathering research from reliable sources, and both working together to implement solutions produced by this dynamic, they would have achieved a greater result than if they acted otherwise. Fourth is reflection. After implementing their solutions, both researchers and participants then work together to review how effective they were, along with what aspects of their research provided results of great value. If necessary, the research group may choose to repeat the action and reflection process to attempt to produce greater results. Okay, and now we're getting into casual research. Although not a source of reliable research materials, YouTube still provides content that is used by people worldwide for information gathering that is applicable to casual and personal research. Home to all sorts of information and references of both higher and lower quality, YouTube is a well of data that one can peruse with scrutiny to obtain valuable pieces of material or be referred to resources of high value through its members. Despite not being a scholarly source of information, this online platform can still provide you with knowledge of where to obtain more data or learn something immediately for personal research that does not harm the credibility of your research. An example of this would be like how to do something more efficiently, the color of something that you're not really aware of, or anything that isn't specifically or especially crucial to undertake. And next in casual research, we have Google. This is another commonly used casual research tool that has been a mainstay of the internet and information systems since its popularity growth in the 2000s. According to firstsight.com, there are more than 3.7 billion Google searches conducted every day, and 76% of all global internet searches take place on Google. Depending on where you are in the world, your operating system, and your general feelings about mainstream information, there is a good chance that you use Google as your quick internet search engine for research. I frequently use this resource to comprehend a topic, find more credible resources, and quickly search for knowledge online. Alrighty. Now we're going to get into citation. To preface this slide, we're going to take a nice walk through citation, and citation of materials used works threefold. It allows for one to identify the original source for an idea or information, whilst also attesting to the credibility of provisioned data. Finally, it allows readers to refer to that resource later. Thanks to the internet, we can provide citations for a plethora of research information relatively easily by either searching for how to perform citations within a specific citation style, or by using my personal preferred method of using a citation tool such as Scriber.com or a citation generator. These tools typically help with the repetitive nature of citation work and make it simpler for anyone to properly cite a piece of information online or in real life, and deliver a quality citation consistently. Citation is more than just a list of sources at the end of a paper. Citations can act as a reassurance for those who are skeptical about the information provided, as they can refer to all given citations to comprehend the data relevant to the materials presented at hand. Trustworthy and reliable sources will frequently provide citations and resources to assuage those with concerns about any research data or products being presented to them. Alrighty. Now we have a short video on credibility. I believe it is a 3-minute video. And here we go. Awesome. Okay. So next up, we have credibility and sources. So primary sources are firsthand accounts of an event or discovery. This source communicates original research, thought, or opinion. Some other examples of this are original research articles, literary works, podcasts, diaries, census, and statistics. Secondary sources are usually secondhand accounts of an event or topic. This source provides analysis discussion or review of primary materials. Some examples of this are journal articles, reviews, newspaper articles, and books. Tertiary sources are a combination of primary and secondary sources. This source provides an overview or summary of other sources. And some examples of that are textbooks, fact books, almanacs, dictionaries, encyclopedias. Alrighty. So next up, we have reporting and collaboration. When reporting and collaborating with others, structure, visuals, and language should be considered. One, the reporting structure of research should include a brief introduction, background, methodology, results, conclusion, and recommendations. Secondly, charts, tables, and graphs can be used to communicate results visually and make the information easier to understand. And thirdly, when reporting research findings, it is important to use clear and concise language that can be easily understood by a wide range of audiences. And that's it. So all my stuff. That's it for my presentation. These are my works cited and all the sources that I used to complete this. Thank you very much for listening to my masterclass presentation. And hopefully I'll have a little bit more for you in the future. Thank you very much. Any questions, comments, concerns, or feedback?
Thank you, John. That was great. That was awesome. That was a lot of information, definitely. Yeah, especially definitely. The sourcing. You know, the sourcing is the biggest question I get from my students mm-hmm. and my kids. They're like, why do we have to source? And, you know, a lot of times the library itself through the school is not. I can't even think of the word I want to use for it. It's just not the best place to find a source for what you're looking for yeah. when you're trying to learn things. You know, it's mm-hmm. almost too high level to actually use the information.
Yeah, I would say it's not very intuitive. You know, it's like you can't really navigate it very, very well if you don't know what you're doing. And it's a little bit of a pain.
Yes. Yes, intuitive, just like you said. And like Alex said, it's sometimes it's too detailed and it's too far-fetched because it's an article. And yeah, okay, we get that it's, you know, based on a specific topic that they have to write.
They need to start.
Go ahead.
I was going to say they need to start with a secondary or tertiary reference in order to get an understanding before they dig into the primary literature. Because that's exactly all. The problems occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it does get too detailed. It's almost too difficult to really find what you're looking for.
How timely. I've got two peer reviews I got to get done by tomorrow.
Oh, well, keep it easy. And that's the thing, you know, we need peer reviewed sources, right? Yeah, I mean, that's the whole definitely. Point. That's what they want us to use. So because my course is one of the first courses, I tell them, you know, you're welcome to use the web, and I teach them, I tell them to go to, you know, Purdue OWL to get their references and citations. But I tell them, try to use a web page from a company that is well-versed in what it is you're looking for. You know, it's not so bad to use Wikipedia sometimes. A lot of that information comes from peer reviewers. You know, I mean, these are people who write this information. So sometimes it does come out good, but, you know,
it can guide you. It can guide you where.
Yeah. Something easier to find. Exactly. So that was really great. That's a lot of information that we took in.
Thank you very much.
Very nice. Thank you so much. All right. Next up is Gabe. Gabe, are you ready?
Yes, I am. All right, can you all see the slides?
Yes, I can.
All right, my name is Gabe Ruiz, and I'll be covering quantum computing. It'll be a rather low-level explanation just to give a general idea of what they are and how they work and some future impacts of them. So to start, visually a quantum computer does not resemble a traditional computer at all. They look much closer to a golden chandelier than they do a traditional desktop computer, or a fun way I've seen them described is they look like a space octopus. With the two images here, the one on the left is fully enclosed, similar to how all the components on a common desktop computer are housed in a case, rather than just having your motherboard and power cables out and lying around. This case provides more than just housing, it also provides an electromagnetic shielding, which again is similar to the case of a traditional computer providing shielding from dust. On the right, we really get to see the quantum computer in all its glory. That silver column at the bottom is a radiation shielding that is housing the quantum computer, or quantum processor, sorry. All the tubing and wiring throughout the rest of the machine is largely for cooling and refrigeration, as the system needs to be at about absolute zero to perform properly. Some of the cables and tubing also work to pull out the data that is then loaded into a data center and desktop setup to be used. This slide heavily sums up the way I learned about quantum computers and how I will explain them. Science is very hard, but analogies are fun. The science behind all the components and electrons and quantum physics of how a computer operate is far beyond my understanding. You could easily spend a few hours listening to scientists explain about qubits and quantum entanglement and electric charges and will likely walk away more confused than when you started. This was my exact experience when trying to figure out how to define entanglement in a later slide. So many people know or can at least understand the basics of how a modern computer works without diving into the electrons, the silicones, the logic gates. Understanding the basics of quantum computers can be done in much the same way. So for more of the complex topics, I found it best to learn them by analogies. So when learning what are quantum computers, I never understood how quantum computers worked or what they really were until I saw a YouTube video recently that broke it down with an analogy that related levels of computing to traveling through an open world game based on your ability to do math. So with that, there are four levels. The character in the game has the ability to travel through the world broken down to four levels that correlate to their ability to perform calculations. The character starts out on their own little new island. At level one, the character's only ability to travel around the area is by walking. Walking is going to be a slow process that is more consuming of both the character's time and energy. This correlates to performing calculations by hand with pencil and paper. It is much more time consuming, as well as more mentally exhausting to perform each and every calculation yourself. As well, the complexity of the calculations you perform is limited by your own abilities. At level 2, the character gains the ability to ride around the island on a horse. Traveling by horse is considerably faster and much easier on the character. Covering long distances is more doable now as well. However, obstacles like rivers and getting up mountains are still not possible. This relates to very early computers. Early computers were massive and still took time to create computations. However, they were far more automated than performing calculations by hand, which allowed for longer and more complex problems to be performed and at greater speeds. At level 3, the character has gained the ability to start building roads and bridges, as well as travel by cars. The roads and bridges let the character reach new areas on their island that they previously could not, and the car provides significant speed upgrade over the horse. This brings us up to modern computing. The roads and bridges correlate to not only how we can perform computations, but now we have graphic user interfaces to display what's occurring, as well as full automation of computations and tasks. And then for comparing the car to the horse, our modern computers are extremely fast and just continue to be faster. So what really is the point of the quantum computer? Well, now we see level 4 for the character. They have really reached all their maximum capability with moving around the island. Of course, the car can continue to get faster, become more efficient and cheaper, but it will still be just a car. So what about other islands in the world? The character creates a boat to set sail on the oceans to find new islands and see what else is out there in the world. The boat is not an advancement beyond the car that lets them get around their area faster or better, but rather lets them reach new areas that previously were not possible. That is the best way to describe how quantum computers differ from modern computers. The goal of quantum computers is not to simply be faster versions of the computers we use today. In fact, for basic computations like addition, a quantum computer would not outperform the traditional computer due to the nature of how quantum computers operate. They instead plan to approach calculations in a whole new way for different tasks. Now let's take a look at some of the important pieces of what make a quantum computer what it is. Superconductors, superposition, and entanglement are three key aspects to these machines. Starting with superconductors, let's think back to how the quantum computer looks without those tubes and wires. All of the tubing that is seen throughout the quantum computer is primarily for refrigeration that helps to cool the computer. In traditional computers, we often see fans or even water cooling systems used to cool components like CPUs and GPUs that generate a lot of heat. The cooling in quantum computers works quite a bit different. Rather than cooling components that are running and heating up, the system needs to be at very cold temperatures, near absolute zero, in the first place to allow electrons to move around without resistance. This temperature, as well as microwave and low-frequency electric signals, are used to create controlled environments for the qubits to operate. Next is superposition, which explains the difference mentioned earlier with the analogy about how quantum computers perform differently than modern computers. Modern computers operate with bits, which are generally seen as being zeros or ones, or offs or ons, but regardless existing in a single state at a time. Qubits, or quantum bits, rather exist in a combination of those zero and one states. That combination of states is known as superposition. This superposition can be seen by looking at some wave graphs, like the image on the right. Rather than zero and one depicting off or on, it is now more so low energy versus higher energy, or wave one versus wave two in the picture. Merging the graphs together for the resultant then shows a superposition of all the possible options that the qubit can be. Another way to think of this would be what happened when you drop two rocks in a pond. They each create a ripple effect. When the two ripples collide, there are various intersection points. Each of these intersections are the superpositions of a qubit. The final key component is entanglement. Of these three components, entanglement was the one where the more I looked into it and the more scientists I heard explain it, the less I understood what was going on. Some explanations would kind of explain what was going on, but never really explain what the point of it was or why it mattered. IBM provided a great example to say that if two people read the same book, they will gain the same understanding, have a shared knowledge of what they read. However, these two people read the same quantum book, which of course everyone knows what a quantum book means. The best explanation I could find for this was where each page does not provide meaning on its own, but rather when all the pages are looked at together and understanding can be gained. So they each read a quantum book and they each gain a part of the understanding, but not the whole understanding. When they bring their knowledge together, they not only gain the full understanding, but can also produce additional knowledge by what they had individually. Some of the areas that will be impacted by quantum computers are the ability to create real-world models and the potential to break current encryption algorithms. Starting with real-world modeling, quantum computers will be able to model this better than traditional computers due to how the world operates, with quantum physics being present all throughout nature. The way qubits are able to be used to make predictions will act similar to how molecules interact and change over time, which is something that cannot be modeled nearly as well with traditional computers. An IBM researcher working on quantum computers stated this idea as, if the physics says it's allowed, the engineers will find a way in terms of modeling it with a quantum computer. Another impact of quantum computers that comes up frequently is how they will be destructive to the current RSA encryption algorithm that much of the internet utilizes. Roughly, this algorithm works such that for two parties to share information, each has a key that is a very large prime number, a number that is only divisible by itself and one. The common standard is now a 2048-bit number, or a number that has 617 digits. These two numbers are then multiplied together to create an even larger number. That number, however, can be obtained maliciously. With brute force algorithms, they are practically impossible to break, as it would take millions, I think it was even hundreds of millions of years, to find the solution. The nature of quantum computers will speed that process up greatly. However, they were still a long way from being any real danger, as for them to break these algorithms within a few hours, tens of millions of qubits would be needed. The current largest quantum computer by qubits is IBM's, which reached 433 qubits last year. IBM say they're expecting to reach 1,000 qubits by the end of this year. All right, and here are all the references I used throughout this presentation. And finally, any questions or comments?
I want to state that you are now versed in what quantum teaming is all about. If you're familiar with what Doc says on her Doc's Corners when she talks about quantum teaming, and when she talks about when we come in, it's those same steps where, you know, you go in through the areas that you're not understanding of what's happening. But then you get into a superposition with us. Those that are here for like 3 weeks, you start getting into that superposition. You start reading that quantum book together. You know, everything becomes very clear. You get the aha moment. And that is exactly what you talked about, but with the quantum machining. So basically, you just gave them another version of explaining quantum teaming for them. Landon.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to comment here. Yeah, this is a lot like going back to analog computers, actually, when we talk about superposition. But I would want to point out what programming language are they using a lot with these quantum computers? Python.
That's right.
I even saw there was Python libraries available. I think it was from IBM that you could download and start playing with some quantum algorithms. I don't exactly remember the name of the library, though.
That's very true. Awesome. Well, that was another great presentation. Thank you so much, Gabe. I'm glad Thank that you could clear that quantum teaming for everybody, too. It's not just computing, it's teaming also. So that helps a lot. All right. Great. Great job. And go back up here. Jose, are you ready?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, 1 second. I'm trying to load up the presentation for everyone. For some reason, it wasn't working. Okay. 1 second. I'm using a Canvas, so I'm trying to figure out why it's not working right now.
Gotcha.
Okay, can everybody see my page now?
Yes.
Okay. Greetings, my name is Jose Berrios. I'm going to talk about the OSI model. When I first got into the networking team into an internship program, I wasn't familiar what networking teams do, so I decided to take some courses. And the first thing they always teach you is the OSI model. It is a reference model for you to be able to troubleshoot and to understand basic knowledge. Basic knowledge of how networking works and how computers are able to communicate with each other. Let's get started. Computers have been in creation since 1930s, but they were not able to properly communicate with each other. After many years of only being able to communicate tasks on them, they were not able to communicate with other companies, so different companies decided to create their own networking communications structure. IBM was one of those first companies, but the problem that occurred with these networking standards were that the companies were not able to connect to other companies' Internet of Things, so a new model had to be created. These models was the OSI model and the TCP/IP model. The OSI model is the one I'm presenting because it is simpler to understand and better to educate new individuals in. The Open System Interconnection model was created by France, the United Kingdom, and the United States as a reference model for networking communications in 1983. Even if the OSI model seems to be one of the best choices for network communication, it was not able to beat TCP/IP. Yet the OSI model is still used today because of how well-established and structured it is for explaining how computers communicate with each other and how networks works as a whole. Further on, we will be explaining the difference between OSI and TCP, but for now, we will focus on the OSI model. The OSI model is a seven-layered approach to troubleshooting problems in the network. This can be read from either top to bottom or bottom to top. The choice of approach depends on what you think the problem might be, if it's a cable or if it's actually the application that has the issues. The standards that are being used for the OSI model is the ISO 7498, which explains the model, the security aspects, the naming and addressing standards. Okay, let's start with the first layer, the physical layer. Starting up with the first layer, also known as physical layer, is where we normally see in the tech world, where somebody has issues with a computer and the IT department says, have you tried turning it off or on again? And the also well known is the computer plugged in. This is not trying to derail somebody from knowing knowledge, but because they're trying to see if the problem is the physical layer itself. Maybe the cable might be broken or not. This could be one of the issues that could be affecting the communications of the cables to the computer, and that's why it's not working. Another thing to note about the physical layer that the ISPs that are connected to the cables to your home could be copper issues, fiber optic issues, and radio waves issues. And another issues that could happen in the physical layer is that discharge might happen, so a cable might break or stuff like this. So there are specific equipments that companies or network engineers do use to be able to troubleshoot problems in the physical layer. Next up, we have the data link layer. The main thing to understand is that the network interface card, this piece of hardware is used to uniquely identify the computer so that they can send information through the network. The process for sending and receiving the information is called MAC addressing. The NIC gives the computer its unique name, depending on the manufacturer's list of names. Then the computer will use the NIC number to create the MAC address. In a big network of computers, for the NIC to communicate with each other in the network, they would need to be connected through hubs. This is why hubs are also fit into the data link layer of the OS model. Typically, whenever you verify your computer, wherever you do connect the Ethernet cable, you're directly connecting it to the NIC, so you're able to access the network. Next up, we have the network layer. The network layer is where packets are created and addressed so they can be sent from network to network. The most well-known protocol is TCP/IP. The IP addresses are created by the network and are the logical addresses instead of physical addresses like MAC addresses. For a better definition, the packet in the network needs to be created with the source and destination IP addresses. It also sends a MAC address so that their information is stored for future connection in the same network. So this is how two networks are able to communicate with each other. The next network is the transport layer. This layer is where the data is going to be transferred from computer to computer. A problem that is seen in this layer is that data cannot transfer unlimited data, so it needs to be structured in a way where the limit of data is constantly flowing from one end to the other. That means that the packet is being divided into smaller packets, so whenever it reaches the end user, it's able to read the packets and put it in the correct format. The two protocols that are seen here is TCP and UDP. The main difference between TCP and UDP is that TCP has a two-way handshake, like seen on screen. So whenever the sender communicates with the receiver, it says, hey, I'm sending you a packet. The receiver says, okay, I'll accept it. And then when the sender sends the packet, the receiver says, hey, I received it. And there was no issues with the connection of the data that was being transferred. The other type of protocol is UDP. The UDP protocol sends information without stopping and without needing a receiving's acknowledgement. This meaning that if a big information of data is being sent and some of the data is corrupted or is lost, the UDP just keeps, it just drops whatever packet it got lost and doesn't ask for the information to be sent back. This can normally be seen whenever we use like Netflix and stuff like that, that doesn't have to have a connection between two sites. It just needs to receive data. So video, UDP is mostly seen like in video software. The next one, the session layer. The session layer, as the name entails, is the layer that focuses on establishing the different sessions between connected devices and computers in and out of the network. It is a piece of software that makes sure that the connection is correct and that they are specifically named different from other sessions so that no mix-up occurs when trying to communicate with each other. Now that we have stuff like printers or tablets or cell phones that do connect to the network, this is where the session is able to uniquely identify the different types of communication so that it doesn't send the information to the wrong receiver. The next layer is a presentation layer. The presentation layer is one of the most important layers when it comes to communicating between the end user's response and the computer's readable format. Computers only understand binary code. And because binary code is so complex to understand, it would make using the Internet of Things harder than it should be. In the presentation layer, the data that is being sent from the application layer and is then translated into binary format for the computer to understand. It also comprises the data so that it is able to get to the destination faster for the end user. Finally, the layer also focuses on encrypting and decrypting the information so that it is able to be secure in transit. So in conclusion, the presentation layer encrypts the data, it compresses the data, and it also changes binary code to human readable formats. That's why here in the left, you can see the binary code that is used for either numbers or letters being transformed into the binary code itself. Okay, we're going to the last layer, the application layer's main focus is to be able to apply network applications to the end users. Network applications are the different types of application layer protocols that provide many services. The different services that can be seen in relations to specific protocols are file transfer protocol that uses FTP. So that's being able to send mail from one person to the other. Web surfing that uses HTTP and HTTPS. That's so we're able to enter web servers. And emails, that's the SMTP and the POP3. And virtual terminals, also known as Telnet and SSH. So application layer focuses on showing on a visual representation of the code to individuals so they are able to actually see something instead of just knowing what binary code is or learning how to code itself. Okay, I believe that the best way to understand something is to have an analogy and to also have an acronym. The acronym that I know most is all people seem to know need data processing. The analogy, I will be starting with the physical layer and then going up to the application layer, because for me, that's the easiest way to understand it. Okay, so one second. So the physical layer works where the vehicle works as the physical layer in the real world. If the car, train, or airplane is broken, then we are not able to send the information correctly. The home or zip code works as a data link because it is a unique identifier that makes it easier to send messages to specific individuals. Because if you have a letter and you have a postal code, then you're able to send it to that specific individuals. The postal office works as a network because there are multiple postal offices throughout the world, meaning that they differ from each other. This meaning that if we have different IP addresses, reserved IP addresses, we're able to send it to the correct one so that the information would be able to transfer to them. The postal worker in the analogy is the transport layer because he is taking the letter to the location. So that's where we see the TCP and the UDP. The address in the latter would be the session layer because it has both the sending and destination information. The letter inside the envelope is the presentation because it has the information that we will be able to send to the individual. Lastly, the application layer would be the individual that reads the letter because they are the ones receiving it. So this is the best way that I learned what the OSI model was. Okay, now I'll be able to, for the last thing, the OSI versus DCP. Normally, both of them are identical. The only real difference between them is that the OSI reference model has the physical and data link layer, where in the TCP/IP concept layer, they're both together as a network interface. And then the application layer, the presentation layer, and the session layer are the application layer and the TCP. So the reason why the OSI reference model is more suited for learning is because it has, you can see more of how what layers a problem could occur on instead of the TCP/IP layer. So that would be all for my presentation. Does anybody have any questions?
Excellent. I like it.
You do? Thank you very much. I didn't know if it was...
I agree. The OSI model breaks it down much better, and it lets you get to the root of the problem faster.
Yeah, and because this is like the forefront, this is an entry of any networking individual, this really did help me understand better of how to create a network and how to troubleshoot it if any problem does occur. So I think this is something that is very important to learn if you're trying to find a job in networking itself. Okay, let me see if I can turn this off now.
No, it's excellent. Definitely. It's something that I could use for my students, too. Absolutely.
Let me know, and I'll send this to Editor. I even have the everything written down that I talked about.
Awesome. That's great. Very cool.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Philip, are you ready? Teach me pivot tables.
All right.
Now you're going to show that in Python, right?
Okay. Can everybody see it?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So hello, everybody. My name is Philip. I am from the analytics department, and today I will be presenting my masterclass on one of Excel's most powerful tools, which is the pivot table. I will be doing a live demonstration to show everyone here what the capabilities of Excel's pivot table is. Okay, so the first thing we need to do is we need to get the data. The data that I got is from Kaggle. It is just the random sales data, and I think it'll be sufficient for this demonstration. To download the data, you guys just need to go to the website link there. And okay, so let's begin the live demonstration. So this is what the data looks like. And we have all the different columns. And first we just drag everything and resize it so we can see the data much better. We got the columns, we got the sales, we got the status, all the good stuff. And we probably won't need the address and the phone, so we can just delete this. And to create a pivot table, you guys just need to drag everything above here, all of the columns, and you guys click insert, click the pivot table. This is our data, the data we chose. And this part is where we want the pivot table to be. So if we want the pivot table to be inside this Excel data, this Excel worksheet, we just click existing worksheet and we click the location, is a random cell we won't choose. But considering the amount of data we have here, we probably want a new worksheet. We just click new worksheet and okay. Now we get this pivot table. And we get this fields. These fields are all our columns in the previous data set. And then this filters are if we want to filter something, the column will go to the column side, the rows will go to the rows, and the values are our values. Now, if we click anywhere here, it'll not show up. And if we click back to the pivot table, it'll show up again. Now, if we check the sales, we would get the sum of sales. This is not very useful because we could just do a calculation in the previous data set. However, if we add sales in the values and we drag the month to the rows, we would get the sum of sales in each month. So January, we get this amount, and December, we get this amount. You can also do the same with the year. We drag the year to the rows, and we would get the sum of sales in each individual year. Now, we can also add another layer by adding the year, the month to the rows, and now we would have a time series from 2003 to 2005. This is all our data. And yeah, so what we can do as well is, this is a time series. We can make it much simpler to analyze if we just drag the to the columns area. And with this, we get a much better picture on each individual month and each individual year. We could see the increase between January of 2003 to the January of 2005. Now, once we get here, if we want to analyze different things, for example, if we want to find which month is our best performing month, we can just click on one of the grand total here, and we just click right click and sort based on largest to smallest. And we would find that November is our best performing month and June is our worst performing month. We can also do the same with the year. Let me undo. We can do the same with the year. We want to find which is our best performing year. We can just sort largest to smallest. And you can see that 2004 was our best performing year. And now, this kind of table is great if we want to analyze the table itself. However, if we move the year ID back to the rows section, we can add more information in each individual columns. So if we click the sales and we drag it to the values, we would get another sum of sales. But if we left click the sales and we change the value field, we can get the average sales of those individual months. We can also do the same with, we can repeat it and we get the maximum sales. So this is our highest performing, this is the max we get from one individual transaction. And we can do the same with our minimum sales by just left clicking the sales column and clicking the min. Now we have the sum of sales, the average sales, we have the maximum sales, and we have our minimum sales. With this information, we can it can be hard to understand what this means, but we can help visualize it by using a graph. If we want to make a graph of all these numbers, we could just insert and we don't need to drag anything. We just need to go to insert and we can do recommended charts. Considering that this is a time series with numbers in it, we usually want to go with a line graph. We just click line and okay. Now we have this graph of our sales data. You can see the increase of our sales data, and we see that month 11 is our best performing month. Now, what we see here is the average, the max, and the min sales. We can't really see them because the sum of sales value is way too big compared to them. So we can just remove it, and now we have a better picture of our max, our average, and our minimum values. Now, what we can do here is we can change, if we just want to see 2003, we can just click on the year ID. We deselect all and we just click 2003, and we would just get the graph between the January 2003 until December 2003. Here we can see it in the numbers form and see the progression. And we can also do the same with the month. If we just want to see January, we just click the month ID and click the first month and see the increase in sales in each year on January. Now, we undo it again. We see this blank. If we don't want this blank values, we just clicked here and we just deselect blank and click OK, and we won't see the blank value. Now, some of the data sets you can see here have different status, disputed, and then there's canceled orders. We don't really want to see them in our values because those are not really sales that should be accounted for. In order to remove those, we just go to status and we go drag the status to the filters. And now we have this box. And in this box, we can choose whichever one we don't really want. So we don't want cancel, dispute, and disputed. So we, and maybe blank. So click OK. And now there was a slight change in the average sales. And that may be enough to change our analysis. Now we can do the same with other things if we want to see the sales. Let me remove the status. Maybe we want to see the country. Based on the countries our sales are coming from, we can change it to only sales coming from the USA. So that's it. There's a lot more things we can do. We can change the numbers, can do a lot more different calculations. But yeah, I think for now this is it. So yeah. Any questions?
No questions, but I just loved it. I love seeing graphs.
Right? I mean, come on. You just taught me pivot tables, seriously. I've always been so confused. I don't know why. Sort of like the same way I'm confused with analytics. But I get it, no. Landon. I get it. But it would have helped for me to know this about 20 years ago when I was looking for a job. Because knowing pivot tables 20 years ago really got you the jobs. But
that easy back then.
No, it wasn't. But that was great. That was excellent. Thank you so much. That's good to know, because kind of being, you know, could be used. I could use that literally right now with my intern master list. As a matter of fact, we try not to say anything about that list. Excellent job, Philip. That was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, love charts. All right, Jeremy, are you ready?
Yes, I am ready. Sorry about that. Let me share my screen. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
This is my PowerPoint presentation. My name is Jeremy Smith. about to graduate with my bachelor's in cybersecurity, and I made my masterclass presentation something that also dealt with it. The topic of my masterclass is the intersection of artificial intelligence and security. I'm a person that likes technology and the newest, latest things, and in trying to think of what I wanted to do my masterclass on, I thought about the movie iRobot, Will Smith, one of his movies. Not as big of a hit as the Oscars, but it was pretty good. And I said, you know, I would like to have a robot, and robots are machine learning and AI. So I said, you know, but things can go weird with that. So I said, let me make my masterclass on that. Slide two talks about the introduction. AI, also known as artificial intelligence, is an area of computer science that focuses on creating intelligent machines that work and react like humans. This would be my example of iRobot. Cybersecurity is classified as the techniques, technologies, practices, and processes created to safeguard networks, devices, programs, and data from attack, damage, or unauthorized access. As cyber threats and crimes become increasingly complex, sophisticated solutions like AI can become instrumental in providing or creating a robust security posture. This masterclass will discuss the useful application of AI in cybersecurity, its benefits, potential risk, and ethical considerations. Some artificial intelligence we all may be currently familiar with is the new latest greatest ChatGPT, or the OpenAI GPT-3, or even something as simple as my Roomba that has AI for mapping and poop detection. Large language models like ChatGPT are examples of how AI can process and generate human-like text, with these capabilities being used in both offensive and defensive ways in cybersecurity. Understanding AI and machine learning. AI is a broad field and term used for any machine software application that mimics human intelligence. A subset of this widely used AI term is known as ML, or machine learning. With machine learning, data is formulated into algorithms, which creates a model that can make predictions or decisions without being programmed to do so. AI typically will involve programming particular rules for decision making. Saying, if this happens, then do that. That would be a simple rule. Like if somebody, the network provides a alert that someone's encroaching, you know, first thing to do, maybe shut it down, or, you know, there'll be rules set for what to be done. Machine learning has that ability to adapt to newly introduced data independently, allowing the system to learn from previous computations or experiences to produce reliable and repeatable decisions. There are multiple types of machine learning, but I'll get into that during the presentation. Slide four is the evolution of cybersecurity. Gone are the days when cybersecurity focused on simple virus protection software or firewall systems. You know, technology has evolved and changed to the point where we all now typically may have a banking app on our phone, where, you know, I was talking to my wife about it, where technology is at the point now where if we get a physical check, we still don't need to go to the bank. We can take a picture of it with our phone, upload it, and before you know it, money's in the bank. So that's a new thing, and technology has to, and security has to kind of keep up with the way technology is evolving. Cyber threats have also evolved as well. You know, nothing's necessarily safe because it's always potentially up to attack. Modern cyber attacks are frequently more complex, persistent, and target specific organizations or individuals, which can yield significant damage. I live in Florida, and a big cybersecurity threat here are ransomware attacks. They typically will target businesses or organizations that can't go down, that must pay the ransom. We have that with a lot of hospitals or elderly facilities. That's a thing. A big one that most people can recall is the Colonial Pipeline situation, where they held the gas and power companies at ransom to get it back so the East Coast would be with what was needed. As technology gets further into our daily life, the potential attack surface has also increased. Emerging technologies such as cloud computing and the Internet of Things must be considered. From Roombas to security cameras, smart fridges, even baby monitors, Internet of Things is everywhere. That only means that the attackers have another venue to attack from. As a result of the evolving threat landscape, cybersecurity must also evolve. It can do so by utilizing AI and machine learning. Next slide. AI in cyber defense. Artificial intelligence can bolster or harden cybersecurity defenses in several ways. One method AI can improve cyber defense is by its ability to process vast quantities of data much faster and more accurately than a human can. Any computer, for the most part, will be a better at computational things and accuracy than a human, but you know, AI can do it even better than that. AI can be used in threat detection to analyze copious amounts of data to detect potential patterns or anomalies that humans may not justify or even see that could potentially be a cybersecurity threat. AI also has the ability to learn from each threat, which will improve its detection capabilities over time. An important step if an organization gets attacked in a cyber attack or a compromise is, you know, towards after everything's been mitigated and recouped, you have to learn from what actually happened. AI will be able to do that, but do it much better. AI can also be used in incident response, which aids in an organization's ability to react swiftly once a cybersecurity attack does occur. Next slide. Machine learning in anomaly detection. Machine learning excels at anomaly detection. Anomalies are patterns in data which do not conform to a well-defined typical behavior. In cybersecurity, an anomaly would be a sudden spike in network traffic, a potential unexpected system shutdown, or a change in the behavior of a user account. So, for instance, let's say if I have an account for work that I always kind of do the same things day to day, and then one day, they see me trying to utilize my manager's password or logins to try access something. That would be a suspicious thing. A machine learning would be able to say, well, that's not normal, and would alert to that. In cybersecurity, an anomaly could, machine learning algorithms can be programmed with data that could be considered a baseline of acceptable to expected behaviors. So like I said, once you do something long enough, it'll understand that this is the way things are supposed to be. And anything that deviates from that will kind of raise a flag. With any deviation in the norm, it can flag it as an anomaly, which could alert to a potential security issue. Another benefit to machine learning is that it can analyze data in real time to identify potential threats, which will reduce damage. Much like AI, machine learning is exposed to more data over time, and it will learn and improve, which will help reduce false positives. That's something that, there are a few systems in cybersecurity that currently will use some type of AI or machine learning, such as intrusion detection systems. And a consideration of that with a organization is, what about the false positives? You're getting more time getting false positive. That's taking time away from the cybersecurity team that could be focused on something else. With machine learning, you know, once it's gotten better, or, you know, once it's seen enough data over time, it will help reduce those. Next slide. Artificial intelligence and machine learning in vulnerability management. Vulnerability management is the process of identifying, classifying, prioritizing, and remediating vulnerabilities in the system. Both artificial intelligence and machine learning can be used to predict which vulnerabilities are most likely to be exploited. You see this sometimes in devices we use or things that are big in the hacker community, where if everyone finds out that there's a potential vulnerability, some people may want to do it for monetary gain and others want to do it just to try it. You know, machine learning and AI can be used to predict which ones may see a spike and say, okay, be wary of this. Machine learning algorithms can also consider historical vulnerability data to determine patterns that would signify a higher risk exploitation. Both can be used in automation, which can help organizations respond to threats quickly, effectively, and prioritize their remediation efforts. Next slide. Artificial intelligence and cyber attacks. While it would be good to help only help, you know, the positive actors and the people that need the help, unfortunately, malicious actors will also get a hold of this technology. AI can be used to create large-scale phishing attacks and sophisticated malware. You know, much like what a person can do, AI can do it better in most respects. And you see things on YouTube and other platforms saying that, you know, using ChatGPT, you know, $20,000 stock in a month brought back $1,000, you know, or whatever, saying that it's great at picking stocks and doing things. Malicious actors use it for the same, except for malicious purposes. For example, they can use AI to create a malware that can learn and adapt its defenses and its for what it encounters. This is known as polymorphic malware. So let's say if you say, okay, if you do X, Y, and B to fight this malware, it'll learn and say, okay, I have to be wary of X, Y, and B. So I only, you know, can evade potential quarantine. Furthermore, AI can create deepfake audio or video, which can be used in social engineering to deceive systems or individuals. We've seen the deepfakes of Tom Cruise and Joe Biden, or a fake Drake or Tupac song. AI is amazing with what it can do. And that's just, you know, typically playing around. But imagine if, you know, malicious individuals were to do it for nefarious reasons. Next slide. The future of artificial intelligence and cybersecurity. The future for AI and cybersecurity seems to go from a burgeoning concept to a daily practice worldwide. Once what was science fiction, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, things like the kit car with Michael, you know, was once a dream, and now we talk to our cars, we have Teslas and everything like such. So now, you know, students and teachers, ChatGPT has become a normal thing like Google. So it's something that we have to think about and think about where it can take us in the future. Potentially in the future, there could be an anonymous response system that could not only detect but respond to a cyber threat in real time, stopping the attack immediately. I mean, that would be as great of a wish an organization can have. As soon as something happens, it's taken care of. While quantum computing is still in its infancy, one day AI may be able to take its process data and solving problems faster than traditional computers to new heights and possibilities. Next slide. The importance of ethical AI in cybersecurity. Much like the Spider-Man movie, with great power comes great responsibility. The same can and should be said about artificial intelligence and its ethical implications. Fortunately, in the wrong hands, AI can be used by malicious actors to deploy cyber attacks. It can be used in warfare, much like the cyber war going on between Ukraine and Russia, which is that actually made news the other day that Ukraine is fighting the war on multiple fronts, physical but also digital, or to surveil or control the population. This is also relevant because in China has what's called the social credit system, and they have a great facial recognition software, which utilizes AI to detect if the person has a good or a bad human credit score. Very interesting. And next slide. AI offers immense potential for enhancing cybersecurity. From threat detection to vulnerability management and threat hunting and incident response, artificial intelligence can automate and improve many aspects of cybersecurity. However, it also presents significant challenges. These can include the risk of AI being used in cyber attacks and ethical considerations surrounding its use. It's crucial that organizations understand these challenges and take steps to address them. This might involve implementing robust cybersecurity measures, promoting the responsibility use of AI, and staying up to date with the latest developments in AI and cybersecurity. And finished. Any questions?
Excellent. Excellent presentation. So much information. Wow. That was a good choice. That was a good one. Anybody have any questions for Jeremy? Well, we did pretty good. It's not too late. I love what you guys came up with. Excellent job, everybody. They were really good topics. Kept us busy, that's for sure.
Okay, I can hear you.
Learning everything.
Were there any questions? I'm sorry, I lost audio.
No questions.
All right. Thank you all.
I put mine in the chat so everybody can reply.
Oh, yes. He said, Raciel said, AI can be an imminent danger in the wrong hands. And Landon said, define wrong hands. A sword can cut others. The question should be, how do we monitor and legislate this new weapon?
Both of those are interesting questions.
Great presentation. Thanks.
I mean, it really does come down to that, doesn't it? Monitoring and legislating it all. So, excellent job, everybody. Definitely good work.
Artificial intelligence should be limited into what it can do. And I remember reading from a few years back, there was a Google developer who created artificial intelligence that was able to learn and improve itself. And he said that he had to stop the development because it wasn't ethical, per se. Interesting, who could govern that?
I remember that. Yeah, I do remember that one. That's true. Where does it come in? What? How do we specify what's going to happen and how far it's going to go? We can use it. We have a lot of ideas in what to do with all this AI and technology, but it really has to be governed in some sense so that it is morally correct in how it's used. I think that's really where it comes to, right? Our ethics on the subject itself. Well, I have to say, great job. Everybody, great job. And just looking forward to the next one coming for next Thursday. Let me know what your topics are, and we'll get on that right away to get that set up and put the description in for next week. Thanks, everybody, for all that you do, and have a great rest of the evening.
Good night, all, and whoever's graduating, congratulations.